Well, here we are at the boardroom of the Concord Free Public Library. My name is Michael Klein. It's a very cool, almost mid-July Sunday evening. I've never seen July weather like this before, but it's been a refreshing and pleasant, even though I know it probably is a harbinger of what we've had recently in West Virginia, killing floods. So, I'm here with Carrie Klein. And would you say my name is and introduce
sure.
yourself?
Sure. My name is Kevin DuPont.
And your date of birth, please?
My date of birth is January 11, 1953.
Maybe you could start off, if you would, tell us a little bit about your people, where you were raised.
Oh, I was raised all of 5 miles east of here in Bedford, Massachusetts. So my family moved here not long after World War II. My father met my mother in England, and he was a serviceman, and my mother was raised in industrial England, Manchester, or near Manchester. And they got married at the tail end of the war. My sister was married actually in Manchester. I'm sorry. My sister was born in Manchester. And then after the war, he came out of the service and was assigned to Westover Air Base, which is in Springfield, Massachusetts, about 100 miles west of here, roughly. That's where I was born. And then in the mid-50s, we moved to Bedford. And I went to school in Bedford Public School System, and my folks lived in Bedford the rest of their lives, and that's my rather unremarkable story.
Uh-huh. And you're still living in Bedford, or are you?
No, I live here in Concord. So I got married in 1994, and my wife and I built a home in Concord. I call it the last left in Concord. It's actually North Concord, not that anyone calls. Concord is either West Concord or Concord, but we are at the northern edge of town, which is up on Strawberry Hill Road, and it is the last left on Strawberry Hill Road. And we are the last house on the left and the last left in Concord.
You are way out there, aren't you?
Some days it feels like that. Yeah, some days. But we love it out there. It's quiet, and we've liked the town. Our son went to school here, to private schools here, to the Fenn School, which is out on Monument Road, and then ultimately graduated. I can see it out the window here from the Concord Library. The Concord Academy is where he went to high school.
That's where you went?
No, it's where my son went.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and so he's just finished his freshman year at college. And as I say, I went to Bedford High School, which is, I would say, roughly 5 miles to the east. I can add more about my family. Do you want more on my family?
Or like what if,
I would think because of my mother's interest in literature and English, specifically poetry, was very much a stimulus of why I started to gravitate toward writing and appreciation of English. Not necessarily why I followed this career path, but certainly appreciation for words, good writing, and the written word. Well, my real hook for writing and journalism was competition, which is what I wouldn't say that's for everybody, but what I liked early on in the process of journalism was competing against the other paper in town or the other radio or TV stations in town, and waking up and feeling like, or going to bed feeling I had won, and then waking up to find out whether I had won or not. But that's really as much as I like great writing, and the days that I feel good about my writing, which aren't all that many, it was when it was day-to-day competition. Not that my career is there now, because this goes back to the mid to late 70s when I started to write every day. But that's what I really liked, was being on a beat, be it baseball with the Red Sox or hockey with the Bruins or wherever they put me day to day, just to go cover the story and either find some nuance that somebody didn't have or true news that somebody didn't have. That's really what I liked.
But it was competition driven.
Yeah, very much. I appreciate the written word. I love it when I've got time to write. You don't often have time to write in journalism, day-to-day journalism anyway. I've often said that what you do least is what they call the job. You spend your least amount of time writing. You spend a whole lot of time thinking, chasing, telephone calls, standing in hotel lobbies, standing in dressing rooms, watching games. All of these things I like, but, the food. I like the food. But when you get right down to it, when you're known as a writer in this business, it's where you spend your least amount of time because much of the writing is on deadline, which is another thing I've really liked. I much prefer deadline writing than being given. This is quite a self-analysis, isn't it?
It's fine. We don't get these very often. This is fascinating.
I much prefer deadline writing over open-ended writing in terms of when it has to be in. I much prefer go to the event, talk to the people, see what you have to do, put it all into the porridge, and get to it. Just get to the writing. It's cathartic. There's a relief in having spent the day thinking you did the job well, hoping you did the job well, getting it out of your fingertips, literally, and moving on to the next day, as opposed to a feature. The worst of the features is the goose chase, where the boss has a general idea there may be a story out there to do. Two things will have happened at the end of my career, which is coming up soon. I will not have missed a deadline, and I will have never have said no. Those are the two things I can hang my hat on. Everything else is fairly subjective, but when they ask you, you do, and you turn it in when they ask. When they give you these sort of loose ideas about maybe the story is there, why don't you see if this is here, well, that's all well and good if it's there. And you can follow, you do this linear sort of approach to reporting and writing, and you get it, and that's great because that's what they wanted. It's when it's really vague or when you know in your heart going out that it isn't there, but they've asked, you're on the clock, you do it. That sort of stuff drives me crazy at this point in my career. As opposed to if they just give you an assignment to go out the door. They tell you, go do the Red Sox game today. Well, you know, if it doesn't rain or if there isn't a blizzard in April, they're going to play. And at the end of the day, you're going to talk to people. You're going to sit down. And getting back to where I started this long-winded explanation, typically you have anywhere from, at the end of the night, anywhere from 30 minutes, 45 minutes, maybe an hour to do your writing. This is at the end of the day that oftentimes you've started 10 to 11 to 12 hours on that assignment before you get to write. So, again, they call it writing. I don't know really if that's fair. It's a lot of, as I say, thinking, waiting, watching, connecting dots, and then actually you get to take out your laptop, or in the old days when we took out the Royal typewriter with our paper and carbon copies, and as we say, bang it out. So I wish there were more banging out, and be careful what you wish for, because that is happening. That has the iteration of the business now, which, as we speak today, I don't know what the iteration will be a week from today or a month from today, but the iteration now is to the detriment of, I think, everyone, is to write it even before you've got all your facts, which is because you have to service the web. So in the old days, you wrote for either the Daily Globe, the Afternoon Globe, the Daily Globe, which was thrown on everyone's doorstep at 6 a.m., the Afternoon Globe or the Evening Globe, which came out usually around first edition, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the Big Beast, the big money maker of the whole operation, which is true of every major metropolitan, even till today, the Sunday paper. So you worked for those three products. Well, the Globe, we no longer have the Evening Globe, but we certainly have the Daily, at least at the moment. We have the Daily Globe. We have the Sunday Globe, which remains the moneymaker. But we also have two digital platforms, one known as Boston.com, another one which is BostonGlobe.com, which is the pay website. And the iteration now, the mandate is constantly to be performing for the digital product in the moment. The faster, the better. Actually, if you could write it before the moment, they'd like that. So what it leads to is a lot of initial reporting that you post up electronically or digitally onto the product, and then you might freshen that up anywhere from 15 minutes later to 30 minutes later as you're learning more about the story. It's not unlike if you're sitting home watching CNN, and I'll only use this as the most recent example, the shootings in Dallas where the five police officers were killed and seven others injured. They're doing it in real time, electronic media television. So you're watching the story change. You're watching the errors get fixed. Even to 48 or 72 hours, the numbers are later in the reporting. You can see the numbers are changing. The facts are being fleshed out. That's what's happening in the digital product for us, because we're doing exactly that same. You know, we're making the same mistakes. We're making the same fixes as we go along.
The same mistakes?
Well, the same mistakes in terms of if you watch the Dallas reporting, the initial reporting was two officers, and then it was four officers. So it's not necessarily a mistake, but it's this constant. There are times, and I know this is cynical, there are times I think they're almost.
Go ahead.
No, there are times I think that I wonder if they're making mistakes on purpose to keep people to keep the audience there and watching.
Keep the edge on.
Yeah, yeah, and that is really cynical. And I don't, you know, another version of that is storm reporting, especially around here, winter storm reporting. They will tell you on Saturday that we're in for the worst snowstorm in 20 years on Wednesday. And they play that out, and Wednesday comes, and it's a dusting. And I really, I again, this is being cynical, I say to myself, did they really think we were going to get pounded, or do they just put this up there to keep us glued to the TV? Certainly on that aspect, I'm damn sure now they're doing it to keep eyeballs.
Maybe they just bought stock in Kroger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everybody run to the grocery store and, you know, fill the bathtub with water, all of that. So, but to go full circle on this, where I was going with the Globe and the digital product, and I'm only using the Globe because that's the paper I work for, but this is going on in every major newsroom in the country, is that you're being asked more and more to perform on the digital platform or multiple digital platforms in the moment. And the job I actually started in the mid-70s when I got out of college, that's become the afterthought, which is to write for the morning paper. And there are still those of us in the business, I'm one of them, and this would be anybody over age 50, that where we feel best is when we see our stuff in print. That's how we've been conditioned. That's our mantra. So I'm happy to perform on the digital platform. If they want a story every 8 minutes, I'll give them a story every 8 minutes. I'm not alone. I'm sure everyone at our, not everyone, but most everyone on our department would do that. But it doesn't feel very satisfying to me. It's because much of it is just it's almost note-taking in terms of, well, here's the story. Here's the story 8 minutes in. Here's the story half an hour in. Here's the story 2 hours in. And the truth of the matter is many times when I actually sit down at 6:30 or 7 at night to write for that morning paper, it certainly would resemble what I've put on the digital platform earlier, but it isn't comprehensive. I haven't necessarily and most likely haven't been able to sort of interject any style or tempo to the story. I'm a storyteller. I like to feel the words and feel the narration and grow with the narration. And there's an organic process.
And the rhythm, you might
think. Yeah, rhythm, tempo, choosing right words, going back, throwing bad words out, throwing lazy words out. If anybody wants to call that an art form, that's kind of what it feels like. So to turn in your best effort at the end of the day is still where I am. I think a lot of guys are. That's not the digital product.
So you make your deadline and you turn in your piece, and then what's the sequence after that? What is it?
Well, you go to the bar, of course.
Yeah, no, you do, but what happens to the piece? I mean, does the editor have his or her way with it then? Or?
I've worked for a number of products. The product that was least friendly to writers was the New York Times. New York Times, I was there for about 3 years on that staff. They had a way of turning everyone's story into the same, not the same story. It was a wonderful paper to work for. It remains the king in my mind, but it was not a writer's paper then. It's not a writer's paper now. And
writer's
paper in the sense that they would not give you leeway for form. Rhythm, whatever device you wanted to use, metaphor, analogies, whatever. They were very disinclined to that. It was a real time style. Again, I left there in 1985. It is looser today than it was. Whereas at the Globe, for many of us, including myself, the copy is rarely massaged. They read it for facts. They do have questions. They are there as a safety net because we all make stupid mistakes. But that has been, in the sports department, the mantra, which is to let the writers write. So that was part of the reason I came back. Part of the reason is that it was, and I think still is, a better place for a writer to feel comfortable and do what you want to do.
So your chances were pretty good then, it sounds like, of seeing roughly the same piece you had written the next morning.
Right. I'm having flashbacks now too. I remember being at the Times, and I mean, very disgruntled over what had happened to my copy. Not that I can tell you today what it was about. I'm sure it was a game story. And there was an old fellow, this has disappeared from the landscape too, which in the old days you would see former writers end up working for teams in their public relations department, often as kind of goodwill ambassadors. In some cases it was a reward for writers who had been sort of friendly to the team. So I don't know if that was Barney's position or not, but Barney Kromenko was this older guy. Barney Kromenko, Barney EY, and then Kromenko, Kremenko, Kromenko. Jewish guy, Brooklyn, the accent, loved him. And he'd been through a million stories. And he saw I was down. I didn't make any bones about what it was I was down about. And he looked at me in this very grandfatherly way. He says, "Kevin, haven't you..." I can't do the accent, so I won't try. "Haven't you learned yet?" I said, "What's that, Barney?" He said, "Write it and forget it." Which is, when you hand it in, let them do what they want to do. And that helped, because kind of in the old analogy, if you can't fight City Hall, the editors were the editors. They were going to do what they wanted to the copy. But there were, it, to me, so many stories are, you've got what you have to get into the story, which, you know, if it's a game story, it's who won, who lost, what was the big play, what was the play that went unrewarded, all the usual stuff. And then once you've got the nuts and bolts into it, the fun of it is to kind of play around with it, to convey all that and maybe give people a laugh, maybe make some comparisons, whatever you're going to do. The Times wasn't up for that. So I had spent the previous 6 years at a paper here in Boston, which was it doesn't exist anymore. It exists in a different iteration today, but it was the Boston Herald American, which was a broadsheet. Today it exists as a tabloid, the Boston Herald. And heck, you could get anything in that paper, pretty much anything. And then Murdoch bought it, which is the reason I left, and then sort of went off the rails in terms of what you could get in the paper. So I went from 6 years of no editing to these next 2 or 3 years that were very buttoned-down, Times-style editing. It was really a shock. But Barney's words still echo. Obviously, I'm telling that story. I left the Times in 85, so Barney probably told me that story in 1984. So God love Barney. 32 years later, I can still hear his voice.
Write it and forget it.
Write it and forget it. Yeah. Yeah. And head to the bar, which we did at the Old Herald. There was a bar around. Let's talk about the way times have changed. There was a bar it actually still is right around the corner from where the Old Herald used to be. It's called J.J. Foley's. So many of us, before we became 5, 6, 7 day a week writers, we had stints on the desk editing copy. And part of the routine in 1977 and 78 was between editions, run to Foley's, have a beer, and come back, you know. Not everybody came back. I fear some of them might still be there, but that was accepted practice.
Keep the machine well oiled.
Keep the machine well oiled. But again, there was no competition. There was competition paper to paper, but papers were, you know, the old adage, literally printing money in the basement.
Printing money.
Well, in terms of, there was no, I talk about this when I sometimes give tours of the globe. It really was the ultimate business model in terms of taking in advertising dollars. If you wanted to, if you lived in the suburbs and you wanted to sell your used car, you know, a private sale, the only way to do that was to call the Globe or the Herald and take out and spend $90 to $100 for a tiny little ad, what we call classified or agate type. And nobody had that business. TV didn't have that business. Radio didn't have that business. The only people who had that, the entities, were the papers. Now, that died overnight, along with what's killed American newspapering and, in many ways, American journalism is the Internet. And specifically, classified advertising died at the doorstep of Craigslist. So for Help Wanted, which were massive money makers, I mean massive. We had this, I don't know, 3 or 4 times a year, something called the Big Help, which was page upon page upon page of classified advertising for employers who wanted employees. So that was the place. That's how you sold your house. I had friends, when they knew I worked at the Globe, the real estate section, which the big real estate section came out on Sundays. It's a tiny representation today of what it was then. But that was where, if people were selling their houses or renting their apartments, that was the place. That was the only place. And I had friends who knew I worked at the Globe. That paper that came out on Sunday, that real estate section was printed at 10 a.m., a little bit earlier. It was coming off the presses at 10 a.m. on Saturdays. I would have friends begging me to meet them at the Globe, to give them that Sunday Globe real estate section so they could go look at open houses or apartments. Now,
Head Start.
Yeah, and now it's, of course, as everybody knows, that's instantaneous. But I could take you today, we're about to, the Globe is about to abandon its building after, I think, 58 or 57 years. It's this massive plant in South Boston on William Morrissey Boulevard, on the second floor. And I can remember this as a copy boy, as a kid. You could walk by that classified section, and it was row upon row upon row, virtually, I'm going to say 100% women at the phones taking these ads. Most of the women were 55 plus, which seemed old to me then. I was just 20 when I started. And banks of these desks with women with the headsets on taking classified ads of, you know, people selling their refrigerator, people wanting help at the hardware store, all the things classified covered. Everyone wouldn't be on the phone. There would be an electronic reader like you will see these days at McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts, the customers with their orders either at the drive-up window or at the counter. So they're giving it a digital readout of when that order is going to be ready or how it's in process. All these women would be working, and this was our automation at the time. There was a little digital crawl up near the ceiling, and it would routinely say 38 calls waiting, 52 calls waiting. And it was just nothing but money. I mean, almost falling from the sky, right, with this digital read up near the ceiling. And overnight, gone.
Was that anticipated?
Not at all.
Not at all.
No. And as I've said many times, we, as an industry, we haven't recovered from that. It was really a monopoly. So newspapers didn't improvise because they didn't have to improvise. If they'd had the foresight, easy to say. I don't think anybody understood where the internet would come from and where it would go, and maybe we still don't know. But if while they were awash in money, and I mean they were awash, if they had invested in other businesses, maybe those businesses could support the journalism today. Maybe. I mean, Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. He's multi-billionaire with Amazon, owns Amazon, and he's trying to figure out what will sustain the Washington Post, because they had our business. We all had the same business model. And I hope, not for myself selfishly, because I'm at the, you know, in terms of my career, I'm at the end of the rainbow, but, you know, I'm a big believer in a free press is you know, one of the major major supporters, if you will. Trying to think of an analogy that's failing me at the moment, but hand in hand, free press and free democracy.
Safeguarding.
Yeah. If the free press goes away, we are really in a pickle. And I see that it is going away. I see a public that isn't as discerning. It isn't as critical. And if the papers go away, true mainstream journalism goes away, supported by advertising, by people paying, reaching in their pockets. To get it back will be so much more expensive than preserving it now. People can preserve it now for probably $30 a month. There's a lot of people who look at that and say that's a utility bill, and they're not doing it. They won't do it. It costs $800 a year now to get the globe delivered to your home. People aren't paying $75 a month. They're just not. The business is trying to get them to pay that news utility bill of $30 to $35, and people are balking at that. But what I say to my friends who balk, and I understand balking, because as an example, at the Globe we just got our first raises in 11 years. I mean, 11 years without raises. So I perfectly understand not wanting to perceive news and knowledge as a utility bill. But if America doesn't do that, then it's going to be double, triple, quadruple the price to preserve it, or bring it back rather than preserve it. But I'm not optimistic about people reaching in it. Although, as we well know, people are quite willing to pay $100, $150, $200 a month to watch television. Right? And I suppose the pushback to that is, I'm being awfully long-winded, if you want me to be briefer.
This is just what we came to record.
Oh, okay. The pushback there is, I assume, that many people believe that the television news they're getting, and documentaries, and that they feel they are paying for it, and that's enough. And maybe they're right. I don't subscribe to that theory. I do all of that, but I also read the papers, and the papers still offer range and depth that doesn't exist anywhere else. I have to bring up a story that's only germane because of paying, but my father, who, as I told you, left World War II and was stationed, became civil service at Westover Air Force Base. His job got transferred to Hanscom Field here in Bedford, which is why we came to Bedford. And he was an electronic technician, which during the military, during the war, he fixed the radios that went into the bombers. It was all, I think 90% of his work was on fixing radio equipment and also fixing meters to fix radio equipment. So he did that at Hanscom Field in a different vein because the war effort was long gone, but they still needed electronic repair. His part-time job was working at a place, and I used to go with him sometimes. It was this has also disappeared from America. He worked at a TV repair store. They sold televisions. It was almost like walking into a drugstore for you know, your prescriptions. You could walk into a television store and buy televisions or radios. I'm sure you probably remember this. And people routinely brought in their busted televisions to be repaired. And, you know, it was usually change the tubes. But I remember him when cable television first started. Now, that would have been right at the end of the 60s, start of the 70s. He looked at me with the whole concept of paying for Kelly. He looked at me and said, "Kevin, I've done this a long time. People will not pay to watch television." Right? So I'm from a long line of a family of being wrong. Now, my dad died in 89. People were paying a good amount of money every month for television by then. He found it very hard to believe. He'd find this unfathomable now that I think our cable bill at home is upward of $200 a month, which isn't just the cable. It's the high-speed internet you have to have, especially for my job. The telephone gets bundled into it. But I think of that every time I look at that bill. My old man, Melvin L. DuPont. "Kevin, no one will pay to watch television." Amazing. Amazing where we've gone.
What's your take on that, on the power of the visual image over the depth and breadth of print?
Well, from a writing aspect, I've written for both. I do quite a bit of television, and have for the last 25 years. Most of the television I do is I'm on as a guest, so someone's not unlike we're doing here. You know, someone's asking me a question, and I'll give them my two cents. But when you're actually writing for television, you write to the pictures. You write to the available video. 90% of your writing is the pictures. So it's, and of course, the way that's evolving now is in some cases that the reporter is actually taking the pictures being video. When I first got in, when I entered the business, typically it was a three-man team electronically for television, the reporter, the camera person, cameraman, and the sound person. The sound person was a separate person. Then the sound got folded into the camera. And now, in many instances, not on major, I wouldn't say here in Boston, channels 4, 5, and 7, which are the three networks, typically it's a reporter with a camera person. But in lesser finance products, television stations, now sometimes the reporter's lugging the camera too. So the reporter's doing the job of three. Not unlike that, not unlike when you go to the park or the common or the fair where you see the guy, I think it's the hurdy-gurdy man on the corner where he plays the cymbals with his knees and he plays the drums and he's got the harmonica going. And, you know, that's kind of where the industry's gone electronically, is the one person's doing all these tools, playing all these tools at the same time. And the print job is becoming that way too. They're increasingly asking us to shoot video when we're on assignment with our trusty iPhones, take pictures, shoot video. I can tell you that. So I see the kids entering the business now from J school. They're already doing that. It doesn't feel foreign to them. It still feels foreign to me. I'm doing it. I can tell you the quality of my photography or my video is quite poor. But when that becomes what they're asking you to do, you're thinking visually, whereas the print job, you're always thinking detail. You're always trying to get people to tell you a little bit more, take what they've said. So much of reporting is listening. Listen to the responses, develop off the responses. When you're shooting video and you're taking pictures, for me, a 64 and a 3.5-year-old brain, it doesn't interface well with thinking for detail.
Now, when you write for television, are the visuals already laid out and you write to the pictures? Is that what I understood you to say?
Right. It may not be that you. It may not be that they've laid it out, but you've covered that story as a reporter. You know what the visuals are, so
you know what pictures you took,
or your camera person took.
Yeah.
You reported the story. The camera was rolling when this play happened, or the people who they were interviewing said something, so you're playing off what they said. So. Even in narration, if the picture isn't there, it becomes very awkward. If you want it, you're not going stray far on your story if the picture isn't there. When you're writing for print, you really don't care what the pictures are. You know the camera. They sent the photographer, or they sent the video. But my job is text. My job is narration. Not true on television. It is narration, but it is narration specifically to what they have for the visuals. You know, so I could come back to the shop and say, I just saw Jesus Christ selling candy on the corner, and they'd say, that's great. Any pictures? Gee, no. I didn't, you know, but I know it was Jesus Christ selling candy on the corner. Can't use it. So, obviously an exaggeration, but that's...
But a motivator, nonetheless.
Yeah, yeah. And I also think, because I'm straying in religion here and what people do believe or don't believe about deities or Jesus or anybody, but as a reporter, if somebody's read you, as a print reporter, if somebody's read you for 25 or 30 or 35 or 40 years, you have a certain credibility where even if they don't believe in a deity or specifically Jesus, I think they'll at least give you the benefit that you believed it was, right? That you're just not making it up. So this is what you saw, this is what you witnessed, this is what you're saying. Of course, this is the same now. I've chosen religion, but politics, business, sports. I think print still develops people or has developed people that if you don't have the picture, people will believe your words. They'll believe the sincerity of your words. Whether they want to believe what you've concluded or not, that's another issue. I don't know if that's going to exist. You know, as I've told you, given the financial parameters or cascading dynamics of the financials, I don't know if people are going to stay long enough at papers to develop that kind of rapport. It rarely happens in television, in local markets.
A lot of turnover.
Huge turnover. They turn them over faster than I can remember their names. Now, here in Boston, that has not been true in sports. A lot, if you went to the three stations today, the main anchors in sports have been there for quite some time. And for me, that was part of the reason I chose print, because originally I did go to school for broadcast and film. It was a journalism school. This is Boston University, what was then known as the School of Public Communication. And their disciplines were print journalism, broadcast and film, which I chose, and also advertising. But I was convinced by my sophomore year that I would go to print journalism because newspapers will always be there. Hand in hand with my father telling me that people wouldn't pay to watch television, the belief then. But this goes back to, as we've covered here, the dynamics of the advertising. People truly believe that there was obviously a consolidation of the business over decades. There were fewer and fewer papers, but everyone truly believed that every town would have two or three dailies. And, of course, in many cities now there's only one left, and in many of those cities that one is in peril. But
number of days left, did you say?
Number of days, I'm sorry.
Did you say one day left or one day less?
I'm not sure what I said. There were fewer papers, one less paper.
Oh, that was it.
Yeah.
The papers are dropping
off. Yes, yeah. Okay. They drop off consistently. And it's challenged on major metropolitans and local papers as well, right here with the Concord Journal or the Bedford Minuteman or the, I think, Lexington Minuteman. We are all in this together in terms of chasing the disappearing dollars.
Now, you related this initially, as I understood it, to your mother's love of literature and specifically poetry. Is that what you said?
Yeah. She grew up in basically country poverty in England. One of five or six children. I have to do that math quickly, but so I think all of them. I don't think anyone in my mother's family of all the kids. I don't think any of them went to school after age of 12 or 13. part of that was because she was born in 1925, and I think the children in her family were born from the late teens, right at the end of World War I, and then probably to the end of the 20s. So for countryside England then, that was fairly typical. It was a little bit accelerated in her case and her sister's case, cases because of the war effort. They were all by ages 14, 15, 16, working for the war effort in one way or the other, either making military uniforms, not necessarily sort of the ballistics or the artillery stuff, but all in various ways related to World War II. So really her only education was the one-room schoolhouse and reading and books and memorizing poetry, so which she till her dying day, she could still recite those poems.
What was your favorite one?
She had one about ducks, an obscure poetry about ducks. It's called Ducks Too, and various Shakespeare. Take a break?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so for my mother's poetry, it was Shakespeare, Hamlet, Kipling's If. And she could just sort of start reciting it, usually saying how much she disliked the headmaster teacher, who was the same. Entwistle was his name. I'm sure she told me a million times. I can't remember. But you know, that was the schoolhouse where if you didn't know the poetry, they took the ruler and cracked it across your knuckles, and it was a much different world. So, you know, and later in life, she consisted, you know, she was beat a path regularly to the Concord, not the Concord Library, but the Bedford Library, constantly getting out books to read. In some cases, going over the poetry she knew to keep her mind sharp. And in her later years, really liked talk radio, late night talk radio, especially WBZ with David Brudnoy. She loved David Brudnoy. And ironically, somewhat ironically, I guess, because part of the reason I got into writing and sports was that I loved to play as well. And I was, you know, like so many kids growing up under the delusion that I would play professionally, which I had no chance of, but we all believed that. And so, particularly baseball, I loved baseball. That was my father's sport. So we constantly went to games as kids, when I was a kid, and he was there all the time. And
was there a little league then at that time?
Yeah, oh, sure, we had little league. And again, very...
This was at Bedford?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bedford Little League. I pitched. I played first base. And I loved it. And those were, you know, childhood days, idyllic childhood days of just wake up and grab your glove and throw it on your bike and pedal to the playground and play all day. My arms being just black from being in the sun all day. And a good day was to come home and dump all that dirt out of your sneakers, which usually stunk to holy hell. But, we all had our gloves on our handlebars and we played. Summer came, and every summer was pretty much the same, which is you went back to the school that you just got out of where they had free summer recreation from 9 to 4. And 9 to 12, we played baseball. Everybody went home for lunch. From 12 to 1, we came back and played more baseball from 1 to 4. And so that was really where I began to love playing baseball. There was a very significant summer here in 1967 when the Red Sox finally won something and they got in the World Series. They hadn't won for, well, hadn't won my few years, but they were just this ongoing ramshackle bunch of bums who I don't know, there was some comfort in them losing, I think. It was, I kind of liked it. But they had this big summer in 1967. I was 14. I was extremely impressionable. And there's no question that their success in 1967, for me and also our lead columnist, who's one of my best friends, Dan Shaughnessy, who grew up just west here in Groton. Dan Shaughnessy is S-H-A-U-G-H-N-E-S-S-Y. And he's been our lead columnist in sports for, 25 years now.
At the Globe.
At the Globe, yep. As an aside, I'll tell you this. He's being inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame later this month. There were three of us who started together. We're all the same age. Leslie Visser, Leslie, L-E-S-L-E-Y, Visser, V-I-S-S-E-R. Leslie Visser, Dan, and myself, we all started together in the Globe Sports Department in the mid-70s. And I would say Leslie's the best known of the three of us today because she did a lot of work on CBS. But what's neat about Dan being inducted in the Hall of Fame is the three of us, that will bring it full circle, the three of us who hung around all the time, we were just out of college. We went and did everything together. We drank together. We went to the movies together. Dan and I were roommates for 2 or 3 years. Leslie lived above the post office in Brookline Village. You know, no one more disinclined to anything domestic than Leslie. Anything domestic. And the proof of this was in her kitchen, she did have a stove, and she used it to keep sweaters in it. It was really the stove. That would be the oven, right? Yeah, the oven was really just another bureau. She didn't know how to turn it on. But anyway, the three of us were great pals, and we're still great pals to this day, although I don't see much of Leslie. She lives in Florida and has sort of lived a different life. But Leslie is in the Football Hall of Fame in Canton. I'm in the Hockey Hall of Fame in Toronto. And now Dan will be in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. So
you're in the Athletic Hall of Fame?
It's all these halls of fame for these specific sports. Canton is the Football Hall of Fame, Canton, Ohio. The Hockey Hall of Fame is in Toronto. Cooperstown is the Baseball Hall of Fame. All those halls of fame have a separate media wing, if you will. Wing might be overstating it. Area. And each of us has been inducted
into the media.
Into the media portion of the Hall of Fame.
I didn't know they had a
set. Yeah. So when you do television or you do radio, you typically are introduced as, Leslie Visser, the Football Hall of Fame, Kevin DuPont, the Hockey Hall of Fame, now Dan. And it's the Spinks Award for baseball. It's the Ferguson Award for hockey. Honestly, I don't know what it is for. I should know what it is for football.
Did you say Sphinx?
Spinks. Spinks, yeah. S-P-I-N-K. And I don't know what Spinks' first name was, and I should know that too. So for the three of us, when we were literally going to the dollar movie in Brookline Village to see Lion in Winter with Katharine Hepburn, not knowing if we'd ever make it. And so Leslie will be in Cooperstown. I'll be there. That's going to be a fun day to see Dan get his. Technically, you're not, this is kind of a funny story, you're not inducted in the Hall of Fame. You are recognized. And they make that distinction for obvious reasons. Players are inducted. General managers are inducted as builders. The media, even though people say you've been inducted, technically you're not. But the story I'm getting to here in a long way, I was honored in 2002 in the Hockey Hall of Fame. At the time, my son was 5, everyone was saying that I was going to be inducted, because that's sort of the vernacular of this. Well, my son was going around, age five now, telling everybody that my dad is being abducted into the Hall of Fame. So, and my son has an appreciation for words now. He's in first year of college. So, but it's one of my favorite stories, because the image I got of that was like they were going to chain me to an old radiator at the Hall of Fame.
And certainly nothing like that ever happened.
No. No, I was abducted with great honor. It was a wonderful time.
So, your two friends who have had similar levels of recognition.
Yeah.
Were the people you competed with every day?
No, I wouldn't say we competed. To a degree, we did, in that there was one time. This would have been about a year. The three of us were doing, this is something else that's kind of disappeared from the business. I've talked about everything that's disappeared. There was a real sort of methodology of developing within the business. So no one walked out of college and just got a job at the Globe. What was great for the three of us, we got jobs at the Globe on the schoolboy staff. And the three of us worked for a fellow by the name of Neil Singelais, Singelais, who lived in Lexington. Neil was the schoolboy editor.
So schoolboy.
Schoolboy of the school sports. Scholastics reporting was huge then. It's still a staple of the section.
Local high school games.
Local high school. So in eastern Massachusetts, the emphasis for the Boston Globe was eastern Massachusetts, which South Shore, Metro West, North Shore, hundreds of schools. I've got a couple of stories about this. But the three of us, Leslie Visser, Dan Shaughnessy, and myself, we all graduated from college, different colleges in 75. I was BU, Leslie was BC, Shaughnessy, Holy Cross. We all joined the staff. It wasn't full-time staff writing jobs, but as correspondents working for Neil Singelais. And everybody called us Neil's Wheels because we were on the schoolboy staff. So, as I say, the three of us have graduated from being Neil's Wheels to the schoolboy staff, from the schoolboy staff as Neil's Wheels to our respective halls of fame. But one of my favorite stories of that era, Neil was this lovable guy. He was probably late 50s, early 60s at the time. Our big thing was presenting the Ernie Dalton Award. So Ernie Dalton had been the school editor before Neil Dalton, D-A-L-T-O-N. And I think we still give this award out, but it was for the individual schools in Massachusetts at different divisions, by school population, Division 1, 2, and 3. And that's how Dan and I and Leslie were working it too. Neil was Division One, I was Division Two, Shaughnessy was Three, Leslie was Division Four, and of course we constantly teased each other about who was bigger or more important.
And the Neil spelling.
Neil Singelais is Singelais. Neil Singelais.
But Neil.
Neil. I'm sorry. Neil. N-E-I-L.
Teasing each other.
Yeah, we're always doing that. But there was this big award every year that Neil would go present to the town that had the best school program based on wins in Division One, Division Two, Division Three. Big honker of a trophy that Neil would go out and do. You know, I never went to these, but it would be the classic high school auditorium. They'd bring the whole school in. Neil would walk out. The athletic director would shake his hand. So there's this one day, Neil's going to be going out to Lincoln Sudbury, just a couple towns over here, to present the Dalton Award. Very absent-minded guy, Neil. You know, he would come routinely to work with a black shoe and a brown shoe, you know, mismatched socks, constantly out on the parking lot. And we loved Neil. Out on the parking lot looking for his car, couldn't remember where he parked it, you know. So he comes in this day, and he's got to go out to Lincoln Sudbury, and Shaughnessy and I are in there, and it's snowing already. And Neil's all worried about the presentation, whether the school's going to be still in session. He's got to get out there. So he's telling Shaughnessy, listen, I'm going to be going out. He's telling him this 4 hours before it happens. I'm going to be leaving at 1 o'clock. It's about 9 o'clock. We're in the... Could you bring the trophy around to the back door at the parking lot, and I'll drive up, and you can put it in, and then I'll drive away. Sure, Neil. I mean, it was easy. There's nothing to this. Well, in classic Neil fashion, he's reminding Dan every 30 minutes over the course of 4 hours, and it's driving Dan cuckoo, and he's looking at me, and I'm just... So 1 o'clock comes. Neil looks at Dan, says, I'm going out now. I'll see you at the back door at the parking lot. Okay. Neil goes out. As Neil goes out, Dan's pulling on his Holy Cross knit cap, you know, the purple with the white trim, this big parka that he's got on. Out he goes with this 40-pound piece of hardware. And I'm just typing away, thinking nothing of it. About 20 minutes later, here comes Shaughnessy, back, covered in snow, holding the trophy. I said, Dan, what's the story here? What happened? He didn't show. I said, it didn't show. Neil got in his car and drove home to Lexington and forgot about the whole thing. And finally, in words that live in infamy, like an hour later, the phone rings. It's Neil. Dan picks up. Neil, what's going on? Where the hell are you? I can't believe I'm that stupid. I forgot about the whole thing and went home. You know, so had to drive back in. Shaughnessy had to hand him the trophy, and out he went to in Sudbury.
Was it to be given out that afternoon?
Yeah, oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So it was down to the wire.
Well, I think what happened, it was Neil handing it over to the athletic director without the whole high school auditorium display. So, but they were wonderful times. We learned a lot. We had a lot of fun. And we felt privileged not only to work for the Globe, to work for Neil, and it was a starting point for all of us. Leslie got hired on staff there and went on to a lot of television work with CBS. Dan and I had to leave to find jobs elsewhere, again, because the Globe typically wouldn't hire right out of college. Part of Leslie's advantage was Title IX at the time, Title IX and adding women and minorities to the staff. That helped her immensely.
Did it add them also to the concept of the school boy program? Did it become a school person program, or did it have a school girls division?
That's interesting. Not necessarily. We started covering more women's sports because of Title IX and because of awareness. But again, we weren't covering it because in many cases women weren't playing, girls weren't playing, but Title IX forced not necessarily high schools to play, but certainly colleges to add programs where women could play. But if I think back to the mid-70s, high schools, girls' sports were field hockey, soccer, and that was pretty much it. Track and field, there was some track and field. But now there's, and rightly so, they've got a vast number of options to choose from.
So not to be a stickler, but is it still called the school boy program?
It's called Scholastics.
Scholastics.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But it was very much the school boy beat. That's what it was. But that was the nomenclature or the vernacular for all departments. And for those of us old enough, we still call it school boys. It's just... We also call the starter positions, of which I was one, copy boys.
Copy boys?
Copy. It was coffee, too, but it was copy boy was the term. The Globe had a term, which it still has. We were called Nighthawks. And my first shift as a Nighthawk was February 28th, 1973. things that I remember here.
A long night, huh?
No, I loved it. I loved it. I loved being a copy boy. I just loved the business and just the sound of it and the smell of it and you know, the smell of it was the wire machines as they typed out stories. They had a smell to them. editing was by hand and glue pots. So I remember certainly the glue pot smell, because they gave you this big can of glue that you individually filled. That was part of the duty. You filled the glue pots for the editors, because they would paste up. You would turn your stories in takes. You were assigned stories by takes. They would say, give us three takes on a Red Sox sidebar. You know, one take would be 200 words, and a take was how many words you could fit onto a typewritten page. So when the editing came, they would take the three takes or four takes or five takes, and they would literally glue those takes together for one long story, and then they were hand-edited in pencil for, you know, corrections, facts, misspellings, all of that. So part of the job I started in February 28th, 1973, was filling the glue pots. But part of the reason I remember the date in starting was I had been into interview as a prospective copy boy, I think about a week earlier. And there wasn't much to it other than meeting the sports editor at the time, Ernie Roberts, taking a typing test. That was part of it. And I was fortunate. I was a pretty good typer. And I think more than anything, it was just that they knew you could converse and talk, which I thought everybody did that. Now that I see the kids today, lo and behold, not everybody can. So... but what happened was it was an emergency that they called me in, and I couldn't get in there fast enough after saying yes. And I barreled down the Mass Pike to get there. And when I got there, and I still have this somewhere in the house, there were large pads of paper, 8 by 11 standard pads of paper. Some of the paper was white, some of it was pink. The pink paper was used to glue on top of those stories that would be edited, because that's where headlines would be written by the copy editors. We would write the headlines right on the pink copy. Nonetheless, when I got in there, there was a pink piece of paper with my name on it, written in grease pencil, because grease pencil was used quite frequently, orange grease pencil. It had my name, Kevin DuPont. It had my phone number in Bedford, 275-6840, my parents' phone number. And then in large capital letters, under my name and phone number, the two words, last resort. Meaning, if they could get no one else to come in to fill this shift, call this DuPont character, maybe he'll come in, right? It was an illness. Kenny Hughes was one of the other copy boys. He'd had to go have surgery for something, his back or something. So I worked the next five nights, and I kept that last resort. And it is somewhere in the basement of our house in an old trunk. How prophetic. Last resort.
So can we... Was any of this local athletic reporting related to Concord? Can you recall... Great Concord athletes?
I can't...
Or teams?
I can't say that I've had a lot of interaction. I was very fortunate. Dan and I were both fortunate. Dan's first job was at the... Dan Shaughnessy, his first job was... Real first full-time job was covering the Orioles in Baltimore for the Baltimore Evening Sun. My first real job was at the other paper in town, as I mentioned, the Boston Herald American, covering the Red Sox. So I went, which was very fortunate at the time, from covering school boys and school girls pretty much to covering pro sports. So in that very short window that I did the amateurs or the schools, I wasn't out in Concord much. I can tell you, in 1988, I covered my first Olympics, and that was... The first one was Calgary Winter Games, and then Summer Games in Seoul, South Korea. And there was a Concord angle to one of those stories, which was, I believe the woman's first name was Caitlin, last name Bilodeaux, B-E-L-O-D-E-A-U-X. the Bilodeau family in Concord did a lot of fencing, just one more sport I knew nothing about and to this day know nothing about. But often when you do Olympics, you go to these sports that don't have much profile. Anyone who's watched NBC coverage of winter games or summer games would know that you're often watching sports you would never watch, be it weightlifting, water polo, beach volleyball. So often as a reporter, you're going to these things. Equestrian is another one where I've had to cover equestrian sometimes, barely know which end of the horse is the front or the back. But I had to go over, because of this Bilodeau woman, I had to go over to fencing for 2 days in a row. So I went over the first day, and of course you're in a foreign country, don't speak a word, and typically at the main, the way these Olympics work for the media, the papers would all have these little sort of, sometimes full offices, sometimes just a bank of desks in a giant room, but the facility was the main press center. So you'd go to the main press center, there'd be papers there from all over the world, reporters from all different papers from all over the world. Typically, the Americans were all herded into one area. So we'd have an office, the New York Times would have an office, the Washington Post would have an office. And part of the drill was, in a foreign country, you'd have these sort of, I'm not going to call flashcards, but little cards that could say, take me back, please take me back to the main press center, or take me to this venue. So, and because it's Korea, which is 12 or 14 hours different, you never really knew where you were with addition or where you had to write. But I was over to cover fencing and the Bilodeau woman. I can't tell you 28 years later how she did. All I can tell you, though, is I came out of that venue feeling on deadline. I had to get back to the main press center, and there were no buses, there were no cabs. It was a very long wait. But I finally got back. The second day, I'm back there again, and this time I am hell-bent coming out of this facility, out of where they've had the fencing. I'm going to get this cab as fast as I can get it. I don't care if I'm the ugly American cutting in front of people. I'll get back. I'll give this guy my card. I'll get back. Please take me to the main press center. It ends. I come rushing out. I'm waving my hand like a madman as soon as I come out where all the cars are. And lo and behold, there's really not much going on outside, which I felt fortunate about. I'm waving my hand. First car I see, the guy's waving back, right? Great. I say, great. I jump in the back seat. Away we go. I hand up my card. I'm saying main press center. The guy at the wheel, he can see. Oh, nodding. Couldn't be nicer. I sit in the back. I walk Sony Walkman. I'm listening to some music. This ride goes forever. It should be like 10 minutes. Now it's 20, and we're nowhere near the main press center. And I'm not feeling in peril here. I'm just, I can't figure it out. I think he's taking me for a ride, as any American would, right? So finally, out of nowhere, you can see the main press center, and I'm pointing, and the guy's nodding, he's smiling. Couldn't be nicer. And I'm debating now, even if I give this guy a little bit of grief for obviously taking me on a joyride, I don't know if he's going to understand me anyway. So can I say something? And I've got to write this Bilodeau story on the fencing. And so finally, I'm saying I'm going to say something. I don't know what I'm going to say when I say something. So he pulls up. I open the door and I inch toward the front seat from the back and I say, "Okay, how much?" And he gives me this, like, dead stare, like he doesn't understand. How much? And I'm, giving him the universal sign for money, like this. He turns around. He couldn't imagine. He says, no, not a taxi. I'm not a taxi. It was just some guy who had seen me waving his hand, just kind enough to give me a ride. I felt like such an idiot to be, I fell right into the classic American, former New Yorker at this point in my life, where you give grief to anybody just for the sake of giving them grief. Just some very nice guy gave me a ride that day. I felt compelled. I did leave, a 1,000 won or something on the front seat. Quintessential ugly American. Other Concord stories? No, I can remember as a kid being Concord memories. I can remember being here routinely for the Patriots Day parade every, you know, this is when I was ages 4, 5, 6, and 7, which is the big deal, the Patriots Day parade, especially when you're a little kid. And I remember always wanting a tricolor hat, a tri-corner hat that the real Patriots wore, right? Never got the tri-cornered hat. That was always a scar in my mind. And I also remember standing on the sidewalk. This would have been probably 1959, standing on the sidewalk at what then was Brigham's, and it is now Helen's. And I was with my mother, and we're looking across the street where a truck delivery is trying to back in next to Vanderhoof's Hardware, which is still there. And he not only took out the front picture window of Vanderhoof's, he took out the front picture window of the adjoining store, too. And I can remember the clatter and the calamity of people running around. I mean, of course, by today's standards, you know, what we see routinely on television in terms of shootings and terrorism, obviously nothing, but it was as a six-year-old, it was like the world was coming to an end. See this truck driver take out the two, I'm saying picture windows. Well, what are picture? They're not picture windows. Whatever the big display windows are.
The store front. Windows.
Yeah, the store windows. The clatter and the people yelling. Oh, God. And we also, my mother's best friend, this woman, Eleanor Blade.
Spelled.
Eleanor, E-L-A-N-O-R, Blade, B-L-E-D-A-Y. All her kids went to Concord Carlisle. We all, I talked about moving to Bedford in the mid-50s. The Blades were in the same subdivision in Bedford then. We were on Rand Place, R-A-N-D, and I believe the Blades were on Putnam, P-U-T-N-A-M, which sounds very Yankee and Concord, doesn't it, Putnam? And by the second grade, you know, within very short order, when I was 7, we moved to Fitchdale Avenue in Bedford. And about the same time, the Blades moved to Concord. And I think they actually moved to Concord for the same reason many people do today, is the school system. Not that Bedford had a bad school system by any means. Bedford was very good, as I think people in Concord might disagree with this. I think it's closed the gap considerably. But the Blades went to Concord and went to Martin Road, which was literally around the corner from the North Bridge. And